Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Lisa Mullins.
Before I begin this next interview, I want to disclose that I have some personal interest in this story. So here's what you need to know. When I was a kid, I lived in Europe, and for 5 years I attended a boarding school in the Swiss Alps called Aiglon College. It was a British school with some old-fashioned ideas about discipline and building character, set in a mountain village high above Lake Geneva with dramatic views across the Rhone Valley of jagged alpine peaks and glaciers. The setting was spectacular, and the school kind of wonderful, but kind of complicated. And so I was particularly interested in a new memoir by writer Alan Kurzweil, who also attended Aiglon back in 1971 when I was there. Kurzweil's memoir details his 40-year search for a bully, his former roommate at the school. What happened to Kurzweil at Aiglon, why it haunted him for so long, and what he learned about his bully and about himself during his long search are all part of this powerful story. Alan Kurzweil lives in Providence. His new memoir is called Whipping Boy, The 40-Year Search for My 12-Year-Old Bully. And Alan, welcome to Radio Boston. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Anthony.
It's really good to have you. And this is a fascinating book. And I want you to describe Aiglon College for our listeners. I gave a brief description, but tell us what we need to know about this school.
I recall it as a little bit like Hogwarts without the magic. My son has extended the analogy by saying that Belvedere College, the dormitory I inhabited, was the Slytherin of the school, and that I had the misfortune of rooming with Draco Malfoy. There were aspects of the school that I loved, despite all the rules and ranks, all of which were codified in a 35-page rule book that all of us had to memorize by heart. There was a sense of liberty and freedom. We were regularly booted out of the school on weekends. And keep in mind, we're talking about 10 and 11-year-old boys and told to hike through the mountains and return on Sunday. And we did. And that constitutes one of the most glorious memories I have.
Hmm. So as I mentioned, you and I went to this school at the same time for that 1 year. We didn't really know each other because I guess I'm a couple of years older than you. But I do remember you vaguely. We both lived in the same dormitory. In fact, we're both pictured on the cover of your book, Whipping Boy. And I also vaguely remember the boy who bullied you and who you spent a lot of years pursuing and writing about. So tell us about this guy, Cesar Viana.
He was a predator. The short answer is Caesar was a predator. And I say this not only of the boy I knew, but of the adult I discovered later on.
But what did he do to you? What do you remember from those years way back when?
Oh, I remember a lot. At first, the abuse was verbal. He would mock my Jewish roots. He called me nosy. It very quickly ramped up to physical abuse. He, at one point, saturated little pieces of bread with hot sauce and forced me to eat them. The most dramatic episode, and the one that gives the book its title, Whipping Boy, came when he tied me up and whipped me to the soundtrack of Jesus Christ Superstar, and more specifically, when he whipped me to a song in that musical called The 39 Lashes.
Hmm. There's also a really significant story about a watch, your father's watch.
Yeah, I think I would not have undertaken this inquiry if my watch hadn't been stolen. And when I say my watch, I am referring to Dad's watch. It was an Omega Seamaster. It was my totem. It was the talisman that connected me to the father I had lost 5 years before. The cinematic shorthand would be that wristwatch was my rosebud. Hmm. And when Caesar and one of his sidekicks conspired to toss that watch out the window, they tossed a piece of my father and my connection to him as well. And I can forgive the physical abuses and the name-calling. The memory that haunts me to this day is the loss of that watch.
Hmm. So, Alan, you embarked on a long journey searching for Caesar, and you eventually found him, and you'd learned that he'd spent time in jail for involvement in a really bizarre case of international financial fraud. Give us a summary of what you learned about what he was involved with.
Well, the prosecutor who put Caesar in jail described it to me as Dirty Rotten Scoundrels meets Clue. It was an international fraud, very much like those Nigerian email letters we receive, only played out in real life. a group of con men pretending to be the Prince of Serbia and his retinue rented out suites at the Waldorf Astoria and proceeded to fleece dozens and dozens of seemingly smart entrepreneurs out of millions of dollars by claiming to be the heads of a non-existent bank called the Badisha Trust Consortium. And after about a year of successful swindling at the Waldorf, they relocated for a year and a half to the boardroom of Clifford Chance, the largest law firm in the world. And they managed to dupe Clifford Chance, Merrill Lynch, PricewaterhouseCoopers, all these major corporations. And the principal shill, the person who brought all of these marks into this conspiracy of bogus royals, was Caesar Augustus. The bully.
Your bully.
So just to be absolutely clear on this, because it is a little bit ornate, the bully from Belvedere became the shill from San Francisco.
You write at a certain point in the book, I began to acknowledge the obvious. Caesar had taken over my life. I tried to convince myself that my interest was journalistic. It was a great story and one I knew that I would write. But obviously your interest in this went way beyond a journalistic tug.
It did, but that interest went completely unacknowledged for many years. I used the sexiness of the journalistic story of the fraud, but that actually distracted me from the deeper emotional search that propelled me into looking for Caesar.
Sure.
And that was the anguish I had suffered, the childhood injustice that I still felt. I had no problems challenging him about his conviction for felony fraud and conspiracy or for the drug smuggling conviction that landed him in an Oslo jail for a couple of years. The hard thing for me, the thing it took me more than a year to screw up the courage to say was, Caesar, you did a number on me when I was 10. In fact, when I actually confronted him, I went into the interview with a message alert on my smartphone that said, defend the 10-year-old. And I had to have that pop up on the screen before I could actually say what I had always wanted and what I needed to say.
And in fact, you did. Tell us how Caesar responded to this. I mean, we're talking 40-plus years later, and you confront him about this finally. What did he say?
The basic response was, well, everyone did something to everyone else, and he was a victim. His mother abandoned him by shipping him off to Eglon. The prosecutors who sent him to jail tried him unfairly. Fried him, was the phrase he used, for personal gain.
But what did he actually say specifically about what you alleged to him that he did? I mean, did he say, I know I did it and this is why, or did he?
Here's the crazy part. He didn't even remember me. In fact, he denied spending any time with me in the room at Eglon. He had no recollection whatsoever of our time together. Now, this is not surprising. At least I say that now, because that is a pattern that he displayed in court testimony as well. Standing before the judge at the moment of sentencing, he declared his innocence. When I told him about all the things I remembered that he did to me, he got very defensive. And he said, well, that's just your memory of events. Mine is very different. In effect, dismissed the consequences of what I was telling him.
Now, after your final meeting with Caesar, he called you and he leaves you a voicemail, and you actually have a recording of this, and we're going to play just a snippet of it. Let's listen.
Hi, Alan. Caesar, the most important thing is that I apologize to you, whatever I may have caused. And I'm sorry about that. I really didn't realize until you told me that you've been looking for me since 91 that I, you know, how important this is for you. And I fully respect that, and I know how it feels. As I've told you, I'm still dealing with it to this day from time to time.
So I apologize to you for whatever pain I might have caused. It's an apology. How did you respond to that?
My initial response was one of joyful liberation. I think I became more reflective afterwards and heard some qualifications and sidestepping. He didn't say, I did this. He said he allowed that he might have done it. Subsequently, he has certainly doesn't embrace my memory of events in much the way that he fails to embrace the memories of all of the victims he rather ruthlessly exploited. And I think that's an important point I'd like to make. The Badischer fraud, although it was filled with monocles and special deeds of trusts from non-existent African kingdoms and all manner of dirty, rotten scoundreldom, was also at its core an act of sadistic exploitation. The victims didn't lose money alone. They lost their pride, their sense of self-respect. One of the victims I spoke to was compelled to miss her grandmother's funeral service so that she could be ripped off in Zurich. Another guy, and this still shakes me up, squandered the last 3 months of his wife's life while she was dying of multiple myeloma so that he could run around the world chasing after some bank letter that these hoodlums, these swindlers, compelled him to obtain for no other reason than to string him along. One of the many messages is that childhood bullies sometimes grow up to be adult bullies, and the victims of childhood injustice often carry those wounds with them long after they leave school.
Now, speaking of this, a part of Whipping Boy first appeared as a story in The New Yorker last November, and you heard from lots of people who had been bullied as children, carried these scars with them for a really long time, like you did. What struck you most about that response?
First of all, the sheer volume. I'm not used to receiving hundreds and hundreds of emails for the articles and the books that I write. And then within those wide array of responses, there was the ex-Marine who wanted to inflict a little bit of Hammurabian justice on my former tormentor. There was this Indian fellow who had talked to his father, and they agreed they wanted to send me a spare Omega Seamaster they had to replace the one that was lost when I was 10 years old. But I think of all the responses I had, I received two emails from fellows roughly my age thanking me for having written about Caesar and telling me that as children, they too had been menaced and bullied relentlessly by Caesar himself. And this is a very common response, I think, to victims of abuse, regardless of the nature of the abuse. You think you're alone. And this told me I was not alone. And when I received one of those emails and the fellow said, I had been keeping this inside me for 30, 40 years, and I saw you telling us what had happened to you, I shared the article with my wife, and the two of us cried.
Oh, boy. Well, speaking of Aiglon, your book and your piece in The New Yorker also provoked a huge response from the school's alumni community. And I want to ask you about that, because actually I've been following this. And the responses range from really thoughtful appreciation of what you went through to some outrage that you named Caesar, that you besmirched the reputation of the school.
All I can tell you is the irony here is a guy writes a book about being bullied. It gets published, and it provokes responses from a huge number of bullies. I mean, many of the responses of outrage were, in fact, expressions of people who did not want me to tell the story. Man up. Suck it up. You're a wimp. I actually disagree. I think it took a small measure of courage to write the story I did, and I think others share that feeling.
Well, tell me where you are then. After this 40-plus year search, a memoir, has it brought you some kind of peace, some kind of closure, resolution to this?
It's brought an amazing sense of peace and an amazing sense of internal strength. At this point, I actually feel a measure of pity for Caesar, but it's tempered by feeling a much greater feeling of pity for all those people he's hurt.
All right. Well, that's Alan Kurzweil. He lives in Providence. His new book is Whipping Boy, The 40-Year Search for My 12-Year-Old Bully. You can read an excerpt, find more information at radioboston.org. Alan Kurzweil, thank you so much for coming, and we're very grateful.
Thank you, Anthony.
And by the way, Alan Kurzweil will be reading from Whipping Boy and talking about his memoir at the Harvard Bookstore next Thursday, January 29th.
Stay with us. Coming up, Vermont-born singer-songwriter Caitlin Canty, live in our studio. I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.